Mutual presents...
Author! Dracula!
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen of our studio audience, for your welcome. And author fans everywhere listening in, a hearty thank you for your tremendously enthusiastic response to the new feature of our program introduced last week. To date, we've received so many hundreds of solutions to the last problem, which we turned over to you for an answer for that $10 prize, that we'll be unable to announce the winner until next Monday, October the 16th. Meanwhile, our judges are reading every solution carefully, and you may be assured that all will receive the fullest and fairest consideration. The $10 problem is now a permanent feature of our program, so get your pencil and paper handy to jot down tonight's question. For the benefit of new listeners, I'd like to say that Author is a literary game which is steadily growing more popular. You can play it with us once a week on the air and also by yourselves at home. Invite your friends, have Author parties. The idea is simple. Listeners submit plot ideas with unexpected endings. Those we use receive prizes of cash and autographed books. Our authors are challenged to make up stories explaining those unexpected endings. And toward the end of the program, they act out a problem for our listening audience to solve for that big $10 prize. Now, we'd like you to meet our guest authors for tonight. So here's our master of literary ceremonies to introduce them, Mr. S. J. Perelman.
Good evening. I doubt whether the breathless witchery of the scene and the consummate distinction of our guests can be conveyed in words. I probably ought to do it in a series of spectacular sighs and grunts, but since there's no use in mystifying you unduly, we'll have to hew to the line, let the nouns fall where they may. Paper lanterns are shedding their soft glow over the cunning decolletage of exquisitely gowned women and Adonis-like men groomed to the nth degree. Now, looking about me, I see various types caught up in the laughing throng, such as number one, teeth easy to whiten, number two, teeth hard to whiten, and number three, just teeth. Fireflies are twinkling about through special permission of Shapiro and Bernstein, the copyright owners, and around no one do they twinkle more charmingly than our two regulars, Mr. Hayward Brune and Mr. John Chapman. Both of these gentlemen are dressed with absolutely ambassadorial elegance. Their mustaches are curled with heated hairpins, and the merest scent of chic lure has been applied to their earlobes. I imagine that this vanity is somewhat traceable to the presence of our feminine guest, the playwright, novelist, and author of Happy Island, Miss Dawn Powell. Miss Powell herself is dressed in Welsh taffeta, as you recall, taffeta was a Welshman, and she's wearing the famous Powell rubies at her throat. Isn't there some famous legend attached to those gems, Miss Powell?
Well, the only thing attached to them right now, Mr. Perelman, is a chattel mortgage put there by the Greenwich Savings Bank.
Oh, I should have warned you earlier that Miss Powell rarely converts to save an epigram. A foeman worthy of her steel, however, should be our second guest, the celebrated humorist and artist, Mr. James Thurber, whose My Life in Hard Times and Let Your Mind Alone have crept into every heart. They will be joined there shortly by Mr. Thurber's newest book, Fables for Our Times, which I suspect will contain more than one glancing memento of his recent visit to Hollywood. How about it, Mr. Thurber?
Well, I think that Hollywood is the only place in the world. I mean, the only place in the world where you can make $5,000 a week and then borrow money to get back to New York.
Any further qualifications?
The only other memorable thing is the fact that the air out there comes in cans from the Mojave Desert. And two grades, breathed and unbreathed.
Well, here's Frank Knight preparing to take the buttons off the foils as he approaches the microphone with the first of tonight's story problems.
Tonight's first set of autographed books and $5 goes to Abram Gold of Brooklyn, New York. The setting is a bookstore, the characters, two clerks, and a customer. At the moment, the two clerks are in the back of the store, and one of them very excited.
Oh, hey, Mr. Harris, quick.
Yeah, what's
Where's
the
that
matter?
Shipment of books that came in this morning?
Yeah?
Oh, there it is. Hurry up, please. Pile the books in my arm.
Yeah, sure.
Oh, hurry,
here.
Please.
What's all this excitement about?
That man outside, a customer. He's buying books, dozens of them, all different, more than I've sold to one customer for years.
Oh, man.
Oh, he's calling me. I've got to go.
Well, go ahead. You're all right now. Watch out for that door.
Oh, man.
Oh, coming. Yes, sir. Here are all those other books.
Yes, well, I'll take this one.
Oh, that'll be 97.
And that one.
98.
And this one here.
99.
And that one underneath there. How much does that make, huh?
100.
Fine. 100 books, $2 each. That makes $200. Here's the money. Send the address I gave at once, huh?
Yes, sir, right away, immediately.
And before I forget, before you deliver them, I want you to tear out and destroy the last chapter in every one of those books.
All right, Mr. Brune. I think your dance card's penciled in for that one, so just slip into your pumps. Why did that customer buy 100 books, all different, and order the last chapter in every one of them torn out?
Well, I think he was a very smart man, and I share his problem in a way. I don't buy books much, but they get sent to me. And the great problem of anybody who has books is your friends, and even imperfect strangers, they come around and borrow them. And what have you got left? Charles and Mary Beard on the American Constitution. Morris Ernst on censorship. Middleton in transition. But where is Sherlock Holmes? Where's Dawn Powell? Where's James Thurber? Borrowed. Well, this man had a very sane idea. I think there's one thing left out of the dramatization. Put that in, can't you? But he asked for the books without the last chapter, but said, mail the last chapters to me, so these friends and imperfect strangers would borrow the books. And they'd borrow the good books and be fascinated to see how they turned out. And when they came back saying, how does it end? He would have an axe there and hit him over the skull. Much too good for them, and he would get his books back.
Well, Mr. Brune, if there are any flaws in that, they're not visible to my naked eye. How about any of you gentlemen? Mr. Chapman?
Well, I don't see any flaws, Mr. Perlman. My mind was wandering there, and I was thinking of another solution, if Mr. Brune doesn't mind. I think that this man was trying to cure himself of a bad habit. He was the kind, it's usually a woman who does this, but this man was the kind who always looks in the back of the book first to see how it came out. And he wanted to cure himself of this, and so he decided that he'd have the last chapter removed. And he found it worked very well, because if you go up to the next to the last chapter, you can finish any book yourself.
Miss Paul?
Well, I think that might be very true, but I'm rather practical, and I think that this man had these books sent out, and that people borrowed them, and then they came back to read the last chapter, and instead of slugging them, as Mr. Brune suggested, he slugged them with $1.25 dinner. It was a plug for a new tea room. When they got back there, you see, he had opened up, and there was a tea room, and it was dinner time, and they had to have the regular blue plate.
Mr. Brune again.
I was a little unfair. I wouldn't hit everybody over the head with an axe who borrowed a book. Somebody's got a book of mine called Karl Marx, Yes or No. Another book, Why Not Try God by Mary Pickford. And I don't care if they bring the books back or not.
Capital, and now preceded by link boys holding lighted torches and a motley crew of tumblers, beggars, and clowns, comes that ducal personality, Frank Knight, bearing the second problem on a silver charger.
Miss Jane M. Geegan of New York submitted this next problem, and here is our adaptation. The scene is the home of Martin and Marion Jones, newlyweds. As it begins, Marion's married brother, Tom, has just rung the doorbell of his sister's cottage. And as the door is opened, he speaks a cheery...
Hello, sis. How's a happy little bride this morning, huh?
Why, Marion. Marion, you're crying. What's the matter, honey?
Oh, Tom, I...
Oh, now, there. Take it easy now, huh?
sit down and tell Tom all about it. What's the trouble? Have a little fight with Martin?
No, no, it's not that at all. It's my cooking.
Oh, well, now, that's nothing. Every bride goes through that. What happened?
Well, I baked Martin some biscuits this morning for the first time.
Oh, now, listen, I remember my wife's first biscuits. I suppose Martin wouldn't eat them, huh?
That's just the trouble. He ate every one of them. And he said...
Now, there, now, listen, up here. What did he say?
He said I was just as good a cook as his mother ever was.
All right, Miss Powell, suppose you slip into your apron, dust a little flour on your hands, and give us the answer to that one. Why was Marion so unhappy? Because her husband said she was just as good a cook as his mother.
Well, Mr. Perlman, thanks very much for that plot. Can I take it home, or do I have to unwrap it right here?
You'll have to eat it right here, I'm sorry.
Well, I have three ways of handling that kind of plot. I do cereals on that all the time. I have my Dostoevsky method, and then I have my Flaubert method, and then I have my Mrs. Humphrey Ward method. And I think I'll combine all three in this. Now we have Marion Jones crying because she made the biscuits and that her husband said they were as good as his mother's, and she was a good cook. Well, I'll have to combine even more in that. What do you think I better do, Mr. Brown?
Well, I knew Marion's mother, and my explanation is simple. Marion's mother was terrible, so it was no compliment.
Well, it wasn't Marion's mother. You see, it was Mr. Jones's mother that made all the trouble, and it wasn't because Marion didn't like her mother-in-law. She thought the world of her because she, unlike most mother-in-law, she said that her mother-in-law was very nice. She admired her very much, and someday she might be old and red-haired herself. And but the thing was that she'd made these biscuits, and then she found Mr. Brown.
It gets rather fundamental, and the fundamental fact is that no woman, aside from a few very rare ones, knows anything about cooking. All the good cooks are men, and society in America is topsy-turvy. The women should go to the office and make the money, and the men should stay home and do the cooking, and that's a solution for one of our grave American problems, which I've been fighting for all my life. If I can only solve it, there'll be peace in my own household, and I think peace throughout the country.
Go ahead, Miss Paul.
What I really wanted to explain was that this brother, Tom, was not Marion's real brother at all. She was very fond of Martin until she found that her idol had a clay top. And then she just had drifted along until finally this man appeared. And, of course, it wasn't her brother Tom at all. It was that man she met on the boat. And so he came in. He said, how would you like to be in pictures? How'd you like to go on the radio? How'd you like to be in rodeo? How'd you like to be a frozen alive girl and have oomph? And she said, how? And he said, well, you can get Martin's $10,000 insurance. So she said she'd make him those beaten biscuits with the arsenic in them. And so she thought she would, and then she made them. But Martin ate them, and he didn't die. And so she cried, and there she was. It was a...
Well, I may say, strictly in camera, that this charming little collaboration ought to flower in some pretty fine little novelettes in its time. Well, the machinery seems to be whirring along smoothly, but just to make sure, here's Frank Knight with a drop of oil for the bushings and the ensuing problem.
In the light of the new feature we've introduced into Author, I'd like to make it very clear that listeners may still submit regular story problems as well as solutions to our weekly last problem. You may submit as many story problems as you like. Each one should consist merely of the surprise ending to a story. Don't dramatize your ideas. Just write them in short paragraphs. And for each one that we use, you'll receive $5 and two personally autographed books. Tonight's winners receive The Happy Island by Dawn Powell and James Slerber's Let Your Mind Alone. D. Scott of Brooklyn, New York, takes his place in the gallery of author-author winners with this next problem. The scene is a street corner. The character is a kindly old lady and a panhandler. As they come to life, the kindly old lady is approaching the curb, and the panhandler, swiftly chivalrous, rushes to assist her.
Here, take my arm, Lee. I'll help you up, huh?
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
Here we are.
Oh, you're very kind.
That's all right now. You can help me now if you like.
Oh, well, certainly.
Now, I'm sort of down on my luck, and I'm kind of hungry. Could you spare a dime for a cup of coffee?
Why, you poor man, you must be starving. Of course I'll help you.
Oh, gee, thanks. Oh, I knew you had a kind heart.
It's a privilege to help people in trouble. Here, I'll give you a quarter.
Oh, thank you.
But on one condition only.
A condition?
Yes.
Well, sure, yeah. Yeah, well, that's okay, but... What's the condition?
That you go right into that bar room and buy yourself a drink.
Well, Mr. Thurber, that kind old lady could very well have stepped out of your pages. Why did she give that panhandler a quarter on condition that he'd go into a bar room and buy himself a drink?
Not into a bar room. The key to that mystery lies in the fact that she said, go into that bar room. The average woman giving a panhandler a quarter would say, go buy yourself a drink, not... designating the bar room. We now fade back 20 years. In a little room... in a poor little room is working an old inventor, well, not so old, about 50, named Simpson. He's 5'2", has a cast in one eye, iron gray hair, and a certain limp. He is building the largest and most important industrial machine the world has ever known, but it consists of huge chunks and bars of iron. Since he cannot put it together himself, being only 5'2", he has to take in a partner. So who does he get but George Grell? George Grell is an enormous man and comes in and helps him because he can lift the heavy pieces. So together they complete the machine, but George is only working on a small amount of money. And little Simpson says, understand, Mr. Grell, if you ever double-cross me, I'm too timid to say anything. But you'll know that I'm after you and that I'll get you when I give you this. And hands him, lets him see, a quarter dated 1896 with heads on both sides. Well, the next day, Grell goes out and has gangsters kill Little Simpson. Little Simpson is killed, and Grell becomes a millionaire on the stolen money, finally runs through all the money and becomes a bartender because he's broke. But he overlooks the fact that Little Mrs. Simpson had been told about the quarter. So she waits out in front of that bar for weeks and weeks and years, and finally the man that she wants comes along. He's 5'2", has iron gray hair and a limp in his leg. It isn't her husband, he's dead, but his double. So that's why he had to go to her assistance. She was so startled, she fell. And he ran and picked her up because, you know, panhandlers don't go to the assistance of old ladies. So she gave him the quarter and says, go in there. He went in and handed it to Grell, and you can imagine what happened. He dropped dead.
That's a simply fascinating tale of crime and revenge, Mr. Thurber. And if I may call you that, I believe that you're the Alexander Dumas of the Outer Boulevards. Mr. Brown.
I was afraid I was O. Henry, but...
I think possibly the spirit of the story has been mistaken. The old lady was not a kindly old lady. She met the panhandler somewhere in New York. I think the scene is in New York. Somewhere in the 50s, and she gave him a quarter and said, buy yourself a drink. Well, now, in the East 52nd streets of New York, you can't get a drink for 25 cents. She might have said, here's a dollar, try and get a cocktail. But 25 cents would do him no good at all. It was just her punishing nature which gave this man the insignificant sum to get a drink in New York.
Mr. Thurber.
I thought of this, that her husband had always told her, never give a panhandler a dime, he always goes and gets coffee. So she thought she would give him a quarter and he would go and get coffee. Or he always, no, now wait a minute. Never give a panhandler a dime, he always goes and gets whiskey. This is tough. So she gives him a quarter thinking he'll go and get coffee.
Very good idea. Mr. Chapman.
Well, I'm very glad to have heard this story of Mr. Thurber's about George Grell, because I'm always interested in finding out things about New York. And I didn't know before that this is the impresario of all of those places called Bar and Grell. He's Mr. Grell.
Oh. That's when he had the money.
Now, by the way, in all this hurry and bustle, please don't forget your New Year's reservations. We're serving a delicious little 65-cent table d'hote dinner, cocaine included. And you can stay around as late as you like throwing steak knives at each other. Ever debonair, Frank Knight. Say, I rather like that. Ever debonair, ever debonair. Frank Knight will entertain with feats of legerdemain, and here's a sample.
The winner of the next story problem prize is Sarah Dennis of Austin, Texas. The scene is the home of Mr. and Mrs. John Leeds. As we look in upon them, both are rushing wildly about the house, Mrs. Leeds packing his suitcase furiously, and Mr. Leeds dressing madly.
Where's my tie? It was here a minute ago. On the chair. Where'd you put it?
By the mirror, John.
Tie my shoes while I tie my tie,
but
will you?
John, I haven't finished packing.
I can't help it. Close the suitcase. I gotta hurry. I'm late already.
Yes,
I said,
your coat's on the sofa, dear. Let me brush it before you
go. I haven't got time.
John.
Oh, but for goodness sake, Mary, don't you understand? I'm late. I'm in a terrific hurry.
All right.
Oh. Never mind the laces. I'll tie them in the cab. Where's my hat? Give me the suitcase. The taxi waiting?
Yes, dear. It's outside. John, your coat.
Well, put it in while I'm going, will you? Put it on me, huh?
Well.
Open the door.
Yes,
all right.
Oh, John, you forgot to kiss me.
Oh, well. There. Goodbye, dear. Step on it, driver. Esther. Where to, mister? Where to?
Where to? Oh, I don't care. Anywhere.
All right, Mr. Chapman, whip out your lyre and strum us a stave. Why was Mr. Leeds in such a lather of haste only to get into his taxi and tell the cabbie to drive anywhere?
It's hard to start one of these things without saying well, but I'm going to try it. I think I'll have to use Miss Powell's scheme and combine a few literary styles, all McGuffey reader, I guess. I've like to collect names of towns out of the postal guide and other places, and I've been wondering if there wouldn't be an Anywhere Texas or something like that the man could drive to. But so far as I know, the only one I can think of now is Place, Kentucky, and that doesn't seem to be quite right for him to be heading for. Mr. Leeds could have found a great secret, discovered a secret. He could have found out it was a fine way to train a wife to dash out like that. But I don't think he did. I think he was a very successful man. Again, this fictional character of success is always a sure seller. He had once, when he started work, he had attended a course in how to succeed. And in this course, they told him, always think big thoughts and talk big things, and you'll do big things. And so he did. He started out selling insurance, and he was always talking big. He would say to a client, I was out with old Haywood Broun last night. Haywood and Jim Thurber, and, they're a funny pair. You know, I said to Haywood, it's time you got to thinking of the future. And he said, you said a mouthful, kid. He's a card. Well, he'd go ahead with this line, and he'd have his customer hooked in no time. He also worked it at home, and it worked very well for years. He would tell his wife that he was going somewhere important and pack this bag and dash out, and he never did go anywhere. He just rode around in a cab, but it impressed his wife. For many years, he got away with it. Then she got to suspecting perhaps he was not behaving. And she had him trailed once. She found out that he wasn't misbehaving, that he just was riding around in the cab. She lost interest in him and divorced him.
Miss Powell.
I think it was quite simple. I don't think that was Mr. Chapman anyway. Are you the real Mr. Chapman? You would have known that that man was, Mr. Leeds, was a shill in a taxi cab visiting East 52nd Street. He had to be in that cab, which seated 18 people, at 9 o'clock every night and take customers on a tour of the hot spots. And he had to be dressed for it, and then they came in, they saw him there, and he'd say, how would you like to see 8 glamour girls and 4 playboys? And then they got in. Didn't you know that?
No, I didn't.
Mr. Brown.
Very brief, and I can't remember the exact words, but I think Miss Garbo said it all, and as nearly as I can remember, she said, I would like to be by myself.
Well, Well, Frank, the order calls for one more sizzling platter, so start turning the spit and let who will be clever.
Get your pencils ready to write down the $10 question. And before our authors act out the problem, a final look at the rules. Anyone is eligible to answer the question raised by the following dramatization, except the person who submitted the problem. Your solutions should run no more than 100 words, and all entries to be considered must be postmarked not later than midnight tomorrow. And now here's the problem submitted by Jacob Paul of Brooklyn, New York. Mr. Perelman, the facts, if you please.
The scene is the office of the Dean of Fairview College. The characters are the Dean, played by James Thurber, Fighting Pop Broon, a football coach, the student athletic manager, played by John Chapman, and Dawn Powell, president of the Girls Athletic Council. As our classic of Fairview unfolds, Dean Thurber is in his office, doing what every good dean should do, when Johnny and Dawn break in upon his academic silence with Coach Broon right behind them.
Dean, we've got him. We've got him at last.
Fighting Pop Broon has agreed to coach our football team. Isn't that wonderful?
Think of it. America's mightiest football coach, wearing Fairview's blue. Dean, I want you to meet Pop Broon.
How do you do, Coach?
Glad to know you, Dean.
Boy, oh boy, 7 unbeatable conference champs in a row, and now he's coming to Fairview. Wait till the student body hears about this. Boy, oh boy.
Is it true, Coach Broon? Are you really taking over here?
Yes, my contract at Hillsdale has expired, the educational addicts. And if Fairview will pay me the figure these young people mentioned, I'll be delighted to sign a 5-year contract.
Coach, you can't imagine how happy this makes me. Fairview is well aware of the importance of a good football team to a college, and I am proud of its record. But I will be much more prouder with you at the helm.
Then it's okay, Dean. I can make the announcement.
Everybody's waiting for it in Varsity Hall.
It's absolutely settled as far as I'm concerned. But there's one minor condition I want Coach Broon to agree to before I give the word.
Why, certainly, Dean, if that's your name. Dean Thurber. What is it?
That you will lose your job as coach of the football team if Fairview wins a single game.
Well, football fans, there you are. That seems fairly complex from where I'm sitting. Why did the dean stipulate that the coach would lose his job if the Fairview football team won a single game? Now, some lucky devil is going to win $10 for answering that question. Why not you?
Write down your solution and send it in now, if you can. All entries to be considered must be postmarked not later than midnight tomorrow. The decision of the judges will be final, and the winner will be announced 2 weeks from tonight.
Heywood, isn't there some way that we could be crooked and get that $10?
Well,
what do you think?
I'm barred, can't I? But Gil Dobie up at Cornell once said, I'm in a tough spot. The faculty is getting so hard that I have to play students on the team.
Well, Frank, whom have we bagged for next week, according to your records?
Next week, our guest authors will be Manuel Komroff, who wrote the famous bestseller, Coronet, and whose new book, The March of the Hundred, will be published next month. And Milton Wright, well-known author and lecturer, who wrote The Art of Conversation, and whose newest book is What's Funny and Why. So tune in again next Monday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And remember, send your regular story problems for prizes along with your answers to tonight's $10 question to Author, Author, in care of WOR, Newark, New Jersey. All entries, whether used or not, become the property of WOR.
Oh, gee, I'd like to have some entries. All the other boys on my block got entries. Don't you think we ought to have entries, Heywood? Well, Miss Powell, Mr. Thurber, your comrades in arms salute you and thank you for joining us this evening. Good night.
Author, Author is produced under the direction of Robert Louis Cheyon. Frank Knight speaking and saying, you'll know you're in for more fun with the authors when you hear them shout for... This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.